welcome to Funny Business. I'm Rob, and Locke's over there. He's looking at me, what's going on? But we're kicking off 2024 with a hot start. This podcast, powered by the Dream Big Social Club, is today we've got the Honourable Jackie Munro, New South Wales Parliament, Upper House member, and all-round legend. We got to go up to Sydney. She invited us to Parliament last year, and you got looked up and down by the security guard prior to entering in, and today we finally got her on the pod.
It's good, isn't it? Good energy in the intro too, like proud of you.
Thanks, man. I'm trying to bring a bit of the heat for 2024. And
do you reckon the upper house is like me living on Mount Dunedin on top of the mountain and you down in Armstrong Creek, down by the creek, eating all the creek food?
No,
with the creek people?
Creek people?
That's you. Yeah. Little Joe Dirt.
Well, you think this is a good episode to kick off the year?
No, probably not. Oh, not my intro then.
You don't think Jackie's a good guest?
No, great guest. Probably couldn't get off to a hotter start, to be honest. Like you did mention, we did go up to Parliament House there, and it was quite interesting. Lots of old school stuff. It was good. It was like walking into a museum or something. And it's so big, isn't it? Like, that was just the upper house. There was plenty going on. They had a cafe and that. I didn't know what was going on. I didn't know if they were free. And I had to pay.
You had to pay, yeah.
I was like,
you can't just take everything, mate. It's not taxpayer money. You know, I don't think it works like that. But if this chat, I think one of the reasons why we really click with Jackie is, like, she's a massive advocate for the startup and innovation space. And, has a history and is putting a policy out there and speaking openly about what the stuff that she wants to be involved in this space. So if you are interested in that thing, with 90% of the people who listen to us are, besides friends and family who still don't know what we do, it's all good. Enjoy
that's
this.
That's communication. Yeah, isn't it?
Yeah. We learned that throughout this chat. But enjoy this episode, and plenty of good things coming this year. Don't you worry about that.
Would have been a good start for the podcast
too, yeah, is it know? How I do it, yeah. Jackie, thank you so much for jumping on the podcast. For those at home listening, tell us, who are you and what do you do?
My name's Jackie Munro. So we met, as you know, in Sydney. So I'm in the New South Wales Parliament in the upper house. You guys in Victoria don't have quite the same system as us. We represent all of New South Wales. So in Victoria you have, like, upper house members who represent certain areas, but I got elected from every single member of the New South Wales public voting in that huge ballot paper that we get. So, it's a really huge privilege. I got elected in March, and because I represent all of New South Wales, it gives me a bit of flexibility to talk about policy areas that interest me, like innovation.
Well, we're stoked to have you on the pod. And it was funny, but like you mentioned, we did meet in person at the end of last year. And
no one was more happier than Chris too, wasn't he?
He was so happy.
Our business partner, oh my God, he was taking photos of the walls of the carpet. Soaking it in, wasn't he?
So for people who don't understand, when you go into Parliament House, you got to go through the police. Is it like the scanners like you do at the airport? And
yeah.
We definitely got a couple of funny looks as you're walking through. They're like, are you in the right spot? Are you meant
we're going to the upper house, mate. And then we rock up and you're on live TV and I'm like, honestly, I was thinking to myself, this is crazy. You must have to time box everything. You know what I mean? Like, back to back, you got the sirens going off when a decision needs to be made. Like, can you explain a little bit about, like, the life of a politician and what, like, a normal day sort of looks like?
Yeah, it's a pretty weird environment. So on sitting days where we're actually in Parliament, we have to be in here from about 9 a.m. till usually 10:30 p.m. and usually we're here later. So we're stuck in the building because we have to vote on legislation and policy. So we're stuck in this building, which is, like, a nice enough building, but we can't leave, and we're governed by the bells. So if we're not in the chamber speaking or listening to a particular policy motion, we might just be in our offices. And when a piece of legislation comes up to vote on, the bells start ringing. So they ring all throughout Parliament, and that means that we have 5 minutes to run down to the chamber so we can vote and be counted when a piece of legislation is going through. And if you miss a vote, it's very, very bad. Like, it's really probably one of the most important jobs of being here, is actually voting on legislation, of course. So we have to be on the ball. And one of my colleagues last year actually sustained a bit of an injury. He was rushing down to the chamber. He stacked it down some stairs, trying to get there quickly, and he had to basically commando crawl into the chamber just to be counted for his vote. So it's pretty serious. But in between that, we have meetings on those days. We're obviously writing speeches and giving speeches in Parliament about policy areas that we're passionate about. That obviously matter to the people of New South Wales. We tried to get ideas out in the media as well. Like, it's a really exciting and dynamic profession because it is all about making ideas real. And I think that that's something that we probably share a love of, really. Like, it's the things that come out of our conversations and out of our imaginations. Like, they're the things that end up shaping our society.
Growing up as a kid, did you always think that this is a pathway that you wanted to go down?
I was always interested in politics. Like, going to band practice in the morning before school, we were always listening to ABC, RN, Breakfast. So that kind of like political awareness is something that I always had in my life. My secret passion was always to become the Lord Mayor of Sydney. That seems like the funnest job in politics that you can possibly imagine. So maybe that's still for me in the future. I don't know. But I guess I always loved that, like, in democracy, we all have a say and we all have a way to contribute. And to me, like, legislation, it's the law and the rules that govern how we live every day. So they shape the way that we move in the world and what we prioritize as a society. And they also, of course, reflect what we think as a society. So it always seemed to me to be a very like serious profession, but one that could have an enormous good impact on people.
I don't want to get this wrong. You're the youngest sitting minister in history.
You got that wrong.
No, I got it wrong. That's
not right. But you got it wrong.
I tried my to be a politician. You know, I said something without really. I was non-committal.
Yeah, but what you're doing well is owning up to your slight misunderstanding, which is fine. So I'm the youngest Liberal woman to ever be elected to the upper house in New South Wales. So we've got the upper house and the lower house. The lower house is your representatives for your particular electorate in your suburbs, like people that you might go to for a problem with your school or your local hospital. So in the upper house, it's really about having people who can, it's the House of Review. So you have the lower house people who are debating lots of different ideas down there, but either the upper house, the House of Review, it's based on the House of Lords in the UK, that we can have a broader perspective on these policies and pieces of legislation. So we're not just looking to represent one particular cohort. We're looking at what benefits the entire state.
From a pathway perspective, I feel like on the pod, I'm sure, I know that you follow along and seen some of the different guests that we've had on the show. It's very like clear pathway. So for some industries, it's like, hey, I want to be an accountant. I go and do this, and then I'm an accountant,
a doctor,
yeah, or whatever. But to be a politician, like, how did you know that you were good at what you do in the nicest way? You know, I mean, like, how do you know that you
could translate that skill?
I'm cut out for doing this, or I've seen some inside. I don't know, I volunteered or I put my hand up to be something in a leadership position and I did okay at it.
I think a lot of it is perseverance. Like, in some ways, a lot of people don't like politics and don't like the idea of being in a political arena where you're in a space where people are always questioning you. And again, like, that is like business as well. Like, people are always competing with you, trying to take you down in some way, trying to do better than you, discredit you. I mean, that's certainly the case in politics. But the magic is when you find people who have similar ideas to you and have a similar idea of how society should work or what it should look like or what we should be prioritizing. And you find those people with those similarities and say, okay, let's work together. Like, we can have a bigger impact or be able to listen to more people if there are more of us. So you do have to have, or at least for me, something that I love about politics is that I can work with people who have similar ideas to me to get an outcome. And I think, like, my pathway, I mean, I went through uni, I got into student politics, I worked for Malcolm Turnbull for a little while, I worked for Gladys Berejiklian. Like, I had an exposure to this world. I've worked in this building before. And having that exposure and being able to see myself in this place is definitely a part of it being more realistic as a pathway, I guess. But I had a professional career as well. I was in PR, public affairs, communications. Like, I was involved in the marriage equality campaign, trying to advocate for that to become legal. But I've always been involved in the Liberal Party since I was at uni. So that's like 12 and a half years ago that I joined. And I've been involved in the party in different leadership roles. I've been involved in Liberal Friends of the LGBTQI community, and we organise a Mardi Gras parade every year. I've been the Women's Council president in New South Wales, where I was, of course, advocating for women to become parliamentarians and political leaders. So there's, I guess I have been dedicated to the cause. Like, I really believe that small L liberalism, which prioritises enterprise and an individual liberty to work hard and have a free expression, and the government ideally isn't involved too much in your life, but knowing that, of course, we want like a social safety net, and that we want to make sure that people can get onto their own two feet if they need support.
What about a movement of more like younger people coming through the system? Do you see more, like, since you've been involved in this, do you see more and more people starting to like care more about impacts of government and things that are going on? I feel like maybe COVID was a big microscope of how, because again, if you hadn't really had any sort of major issues in your life and you went about things, it was sort of, it's like whatever's going on. But all of a sudden it was like that massive thing where it's like, all right, cool. There are rules and regulations that other people can make decisions on our behalf and things like that. Have you seen or noticed a change in the type of people that maybe want to attract and go down this pathway?
I think it's a really good point. Like, in a way, things are going best when nobody cares about politics, because they don't need to worry about what's impacting their lives because things are working reasonably well. It's when there are big moments of change, or where you have kind of you might have like a global impact of some policy or some external kind of threat almost, that gives people a reason to think about, like, am I safe? Am I free? Am I in control of my own life? And COVID was a great example of when those things sort of fell away. Like, we had this external threat. We needed to kind of band together, but it meant sacrificing some of our own freedom to do that. And like, they're big questions. Like, they're sort of fundamental, what does it mean to be human questions in a way. Like, what control and power do I have over my own life? What responsibility do I have to my neighbor, or to my family, or to the wider society? Like, those are really serious questions about how to live day to day. And usually we don't have to think about those things in such like a serious way, like a sort of life or death way for many people. And I think that climate change is another of those issues. Like, yes, it takes a bigger time scale, but it's definitely a reason that younger people are becoming more politically active and engaged. It's an existential issue. And I would say the other one that's emerging at the moment, and this is true in a lot of Western democracies, is housing. Like, people who are getting into their first careers, even starting uni or like starting TAFE or getting out of school and just wondering, what do I do? And feeling like their pathways are constrained at the moment because of cost of living, because of high interest rates, like, how can I ever get a house? That has been like a kind of fundamental Australian dream for a long time. So when those things start to escape people's reach, that's when people start going, well, things aren't working and I do need to speak up because it's not working for me. So, yeah, that was kind of a long answer. But
what about like prioritization? Like, you're getting people with all these different issues and all these different groups, and that's all really important to them. But how do you process that for you and go, well, here's where I need to spend my energy. Here's what I need to think about more. I need to invest more time into it. Like, how do you prioritize that?
How would you go as an active listener? Locke would be very
in one ear, out the other. I reckon I'd need someone there, like, making notes for sure.
Yeah, you can get you can get good programs that will like record a meeting and then transcribe it all for you, so you've got a record.
I need that.
And it's good to be able to live your life on a podcast as well, because then you can always remember what you said.
Well, that's what I mean. I do all the editing, Jackie, so I listen to every single word and I feel like I'm getting dumber and dumber.
Sometimes I look back on things that I wrote 10 years ago. I'm like, wow, that was good stuff. Such a insight. Where did that go?
That's what I constantly look back at my stuff and go, that was the golden years, wasn't it?
Yeah, I know. Where's the downhill? God. But I guess the hopefulness of like prioritization is that hopefully the beauty of a democracy is that it is broadly representative of our society. So in Parliament, we have people from all different backgrounds who have been teachers, who have been doctors, who have been nurses, who have been in business and who have been in startups and tech. Like, for me personally, I've really focused on housing and innovation because I think they're two key things that lead to prosperity, which is good for everyone. And I think that, like, housing is just the kind of surface issue, right? Underneath, you're looking at tax reform, like you're looking at wholesale tax reform, where you need to make the system fairer at a really like basic level. But there are a lot of steps in between that and like looking to buy your first home as like a person who is in the streets. So prioritization, I think, is making sure for me that it's like responding to the issues of the day, but taking a long-term view of that shift. Like, we can't just have, in my view, we can't just throw government money at a problem all the time because there are too many problems and that's not a good functional government, because then you need to increase taxes and then people don't have money of their own. And so the kind of systemic change is, well, how do we change our tax system, which will allow people to remove stamp duty, so you don't have to save an extra 30 or 50K for your first home. You actually have like a small land tax that you pay every year instead. And so that's reducing a barrier to getting into the housing market. So it's like getting those like everyday problems and coming up with solutions that will be good for the most amount of people over a long period of time. And yeah, then with innovation, like it's a super fun area to focus in. I think like people who are in startups and business and enterprise are motivated and excited and they're trying to solve problems and they're relentless and honest. And I love all of that, but the benefit is huge. Like whether it's the solutions themselves that people come up with, like, managing traffic flows better so that we can all get to work and home more quickly, or whether it's just like the financial benefit of creating more jobs and then you've got more people earning an income, so you've got more tax in your system and you've got a like healthier society in that way as well. So yeah, I guess everyone has their own way of prioritizing, but their thing.
I feel like we're in a really weird point, you know what I mean? Like it's a generational change. There's like everyone talks about the transfer of wealth between the aging population of Australia and the next generation of people coming through. And you mentioned before from a housing perspective of what the original Australian dream was, is buy a house, have the picket fence, be able to work and be able to support yourself. Whereas sort of the way the world's going now, it seems a very much, it's not within reach for general population. So we have these combos with our parents and things going on. Like,
bought a house for 20 grand.
Bought a house for 20 grand. It's all good. But like, life's so different now. And I can understand why you think your housing innovation is so linked, because it's like you have to think outside the box to be able to still have some form of whatever the new dream is. Like, the dream is going to be achievable for a portion of society, but it's not for everyone. And what does that actually look like? I'm sure you've had plenty of discussions and debates on that sort of topic with people in your time.
Yeah, joining houses and people living together.
I think there's a lot of things coming up when you look at like equity crowdfunding, the rise of people sort of like crowdsourcing and crowdfunding and different ideas and concepts and projects and people going in and buying property together, or there's like lots of different stuff, which is, it may not be like first preference, you know what I mean? Like first preference, yeah, I want a house across the road from the beach. Yeah. That's
five bedrooms and lots of space.
That sounds pretty good to me.
What are your thoughts on this? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that's right. Like, people will try to find a way through. Like, we all have to kind of live each day and we've got to get through. So people will be creative about those different pathways. And actually, like years ago, I was trying to put something forward through the Liberal Party about exactly what you were talking about, like joint ownership. And the problem there is really that banks won't give you a loan if you're just chipping in with your friend, which is a problem because the composition of our society is changing. Like people are getting married later. The like share houses are much more common, even into like 30. Like quite a few of my friends, actually a lot of them in tech, love living together. Like they have an okay salary, and by pooling it together, they can rent a great place together, and it's a really efficient use of a bigger house, for example, because they're, you know, they're all using the bedrooms, and that's really cool. But they can't buy anything because they're like their banks won't loan money to them and allow them to purchase that property together. So there are creative ways. I guess at the moment, like the thing that drives me is the idea that, and this isn't just at the moment, this is like a kind of fundamental idea that ideally we have a society where people have choice. Like some people might choose to rent, some people might choose to buy. At the moment, the split between home ownership and renting is about 2/3 to 1/3. So a third rent, a third have a mortgage, and a third own their home outright. So that's kind of the balance at the moment. And with the crunch of interest rates, for example, getting higher now, those people who had a mortgage and were kind of going pretty well on low interest rates and now going, okay, things are actually getting a little bit more difficult for me. Like having a home that this expensive is actually causing me a bit of stress. So people who are renting and people who have a mortgage are now more stressed than the like just people who had a mortgage and owned. So we're seeing a shift on the kind of view of how the housing system is working or not working for people at the moment. And this is what leads to change. Like this, I think that discontentment with the current situation is where like policy change is possible because you've got enough focus on it. You've got politicians who are willing to speak out on it because there are votes in it. Like those lower house members who are representing particular areas, they want to get elected in the next term. So they want to be saying things that their constituents will respond to and will say, okay, that policy will make my life easier. So I think, as you said, like people will find a way in their own lives around the current situation in you know, different ways. And I actually spoke to a really interesting company a couple of weeks ago who are looking at finding houses that have empty rooms, like people who own homes that have empty rooms. Maybe they're investment properties. Maybe it's the like, maybe it's the primary residence, but they're providing a platform for those empty rooms to be rented in a long-term way. It's like Airbnb, but for like proper rental situations. And again, like it's kind of like a market solution that people have come up with, but it's not necessarily ideal if you haven't got policies underneath that encourage the efficient use of rooms and houses and land.
What about for yourself, like forming ideas? So do you write it down? Do you cut out time to think about stuff and what you've like heard and how you're going to formulate that and present that?
Definitely. Writing is so important. And I speak to a lot of people who allow me access to their expertise. Like, I don't think you can do this job without the enormous generosity of people in various fields who are willing to take some time to explain an issue, to explain their point of view, and like give you the decades of their work and expertise in an area. So getting all of that information together and then thinking, okay, what is going to be the most useful for a problem? Who's this going to help? Will it be politically sellable, essentially? Those things for me personally definitely require writing out. And actually, like, I love the process of even writing speeches or formulating speeches for Parliament because, again, that's another way to think about these issues. And in this job, you're forced to think about these things all the time. So in a way, that helps, like having a deadline of I need to do a speech in Parliament that is going to be on the public record forever. Like, that's a pretty good motivator to think about an issue and to come to an idea that's cogent and interesting. And maybe, like, you know, I don't always have a solution to the things I speak about, but part of being a contributor to these discussions is talking about the different problems, and different experts have talked about these different things. So, you know, as a collective, we can talk about these issues and come up with solutions together.
What about writing for other people? You mentioned before you started your career doing some different writing and different pieces, and your background in PR and that. How do you approach doing some of that? I guess the skill set of, do you have to write in different tones or understand how other people might talk and the language they might use versus writing something for yourself?
Yeah, that's super interesting. Definitely it's a freedom now that I have that I can write for myself. And actually when I was working in politics for politicians, I loved writing, and you do have to take on the tone of somebody else. Like that's your job. I am not a person of my own thoughts and feelings when I'm working for another politician or even a client. Like when I was in PR and public affairs, like I'm representing someone else, and I have a job to do that is not about me at all. And not to say that like politics and my role now is about me per se, but it's just like a different way of engaging with an idea, I guess, that I can find my own voice in this role. And when I was working for Gladys Berejiklian, I really got very angry about the lockout laws that were in place in Sydney and across some parts of New South Wales. And that was a point that I found it very difficult to swallow somebody else's ideas. Like they really came into conflict with my own. And I got in a little bit of trouble at the time because I was photographed at a Keep Sydney Open rally while I was working for the government that had introduced the lockout laws. And that was really a moment for me where I went, you know what, this, like, I need to take some time for my own ideas and like, what do I really think? Like, what's my view? And do I think it's worth giving up a job to actually pursue that passion? And in the end, like, I mean, I'm really glad that I stuck to my guns, and I think history proved me right in that. I thought the lockout laws were ridiculous for lots of different reasons, but I guess it's always a balance when you're finding your own voice versus like doing a job to represent someone else's. But, you know, listening to speeches is always a really helpful way that I found to like get someone's tone. Even having a phone conversation with them was always useful. Like when I was doing the marriage equality campaign, I was ghostwriting a lot of articles for people who they agreed with legalizing same-sex marriage, but they didn't necessarily have the time to put behind their own work. So you have to help them construct things, and having a phone conversation with them, it was always really helpful. So if anyone is doing that kind of work, like try to get into the mindset of somebody else in any way you can.
If I wrote one for Lock, I'd just be like, that's crazy. Love that.
Yeah, 100%. I've got a few catchphrases. Very basic. I make it easy for people to remember me. You know, it's like the Simpsons, you know, you got to have a few things like dough, you know.
That's true. That's good marketing. That's great marketing. I think you also have good hats, which is also good marketing.
Yeah, we need to actually get the hats firing again. People know us for our hats, don't they? Because they try and cover up his ruffled hair at the moment. He's feeling a bit unhinged.
I'm getting more and more grey. It's disappointing. And you can't really...
George Clooney look.
Yeah, I'll take that. But
I've got a question. Like, context switching. Like, meeting people, hearing their story, going in, you're all right, you got to completely change from that situation to that situation. How do you get yourself up and get in the zone if it happens so quickly? Because I feel like it does.
It's a mentally exhausting.
Crazy.
Yeah, I think with meetings, I always go in with, like, obviously you want to have a little bit of background on people as much as possible, but I love asking questions, and that helps me not only to, like, take a moment and regroup and make sure I'm kind of present for a person, but it also gives me an insight into how they think about an issue, because I already know how I think about an issue. What is interesting to me in those meetings is how somebody else is constructing an idea, or like how their framework of thinking means that their ideas are different to mine. And I think asking questions is like a fabulous way to get into that quickly, while also giving me a bit of space to just like say, okay, I'm in a new moment right now.
Buy yourself some time while you stalk them on LinkedIn or something. And like, I think it was that name. That's what I do. I buy time. I'm just like, hey, how are you? Yeah, yeah, I reckon you look familiar.
It's like my sister's a vet, and she had to do she had to do a surgery the other day, and she was like, she had never done it before, and I was like,
she might get fired.
She might get fired. I'm gonna say that. And then she's a doctor, so
the only doctor in the family.
I just assumed that she should know that, but she had to do a surgery, and then I was like, oh, how'd you find out? She's like, I just Googled it. I was like,
yeah, watch a YouTube tutorial on 1.25 speed with the goggles on and everything.
I don't reckon that's how you should do it, but anyway.
Well, that says to me that I could be a doctor. That's
100%.
Yeah, if you listen to Alice, bad luck, mate. Vets
are amazing. Like, human doctors just have to operate on humans, and human bodies are like largely similar. Vets are incredible. Like, they are just taking on the full gamut of our ecosystem. That's incredible. So
yeah, there's a few being animals in that too.
Other vets need to hear that. My sister, she already knows that she's
got a very big head as is, doesn't she?
It's a bit of a head wobble. She knows she likes to call you, I've saved a life today, saved three lives today. All right, we get it.
And then you're like, how many cheeseburgers did you eat though?
Yeah. And that's like, we're saving lives one podcast at a time.
Yeah, changing minds. It's all good, you know.
I'd love to chat about something that obviously we connected on, which is startups, innovations, culture of business, and things that we've talked about. I know it's specifically for you, it's in New South Wales, but we'd love to get into your thoughts on the current state of Aussie business and why you like the startup space in general.
Yeah. Well, I was actually thinking about this yesterday, like, where was my first foray into like entrepreneurialism? And it was definitely at the family farm, which is about an hour out of Goulburn. And we used to collect horse poo and put it in a bag, and we would sit at the end of the driveway and sell horse manure to the people that were going by for their gardens and their beautiful country gardens. So it was, that was probably my first attempt at being a business person. And then since then, like at uni, I was really fortunate to be exposed to people who had that, like, just so innately had this entrepreneurial mindset. And I was involved in student politics at the time, and I was able to help set up the University of Sydney's incubate program. And that has been like quite groundbreaking, not just in New South Wales, but in Australia, as that kind of university partnership between like students going through business, science, whatever, and being able to, like we were saying earlier, make their ideas real. Like, it's not just in a textbook, or it's not just in an essay or a lab. It's actually saying, well, I have this thing that nobody has thought of before, or I have this problem that no one seems to be addressing, and I have the desire to focus on that. And I was able to see that, like, blossom with the right environment, like with mentorship, with access to capital and access to business relationships that students might not otherwise be able to make. And through that dedicated program, you've built an environment where people feel like what their idea is actually possible to make real and will have an impact, and obviously will make them some money as well. Like, you want it to be sustainable as well as impactful. So I think being able to see that at work from university gave me a real appreciation of not just like the people behind the ideas, but the importance of that kind of ecosystem. So I've, again, like, been fortunate through my career to work with startups. One of my favorite ones recently has been Eden Brew. They've actually moved to Victoria because the Victorian government gave them a really generous grant, and Eden Brew had this amazing story in New South Wales. They set up with Norco. So basically their idea and their product is milk without the cow. So they exactly replicate cow's milk in like a chemistry sense. And they partnered with this milk cooperative, and they're using their factory. And it's an incredible product for reduced environmental impact, and they got to a point where their operating environment in New South Wales was not as good as what it could be elsewhere. So when I was working like with them, for them, before I got into Parliament, it was all about comms and helping them to create a narrative around their product and the language that they were using to communicate. It's like essentially a new product. Like it really was a new product. And kind of like world leading, it partnered with CSIRO and Main Sequence Ventures. So they, like, what I saw and what I see is that their operating environment was better elsewhere, so they leave New South Wales. So when I get into government, or get into Parliament, not in government yet, still in opposition, but I get into Parliament and I say, okay, I finally have an opportunity to actually make a difference to the regulatory environment, to the grant system, to hold the government to account, to make sure that innovators and entrepreneurs and startups have a place to thrive. That is super exciting for me, because I fear that if we don't have that sustained effort, we lose the momentum that we've built up over time. And I'm worried that I haven't seen a great deal of effort being put into that space in New South Wales since the new government came in.
One of the things I think that we've noticed based on our chats that with founders or people in the ecosystem, whether here or based in anywhere in Australia, is just how hard it is as the role of a founder. You know what I mean? Like there's different pathways that people can take, whether they're going to bootstrap it and do it themselves, or they come from sort of family money that can support them through things. But they're sort of people that are taking big risks. So they're putting their livelihoods on hold. You're talking earlier about like housing opportunities and
relationships
yeah. and ability to get a loan as a small business or all those sort of different things. And for us, I think it's just such an interesting space. Like we feel like we sort of fell into the world of startups and learning more about, I guess, the pressure that's attached to making something good. And obviously founders play in the upside if they have a successful, they manage to get their startup be successful and they make some money out of it, or they get a sale, acquisition, whatever. You know what I mean? That's the good stuff of the dream of why people go and start something in the first place. But from like a role in government perspective, how do you think founders and small businesses should be supported?
Yeah. So I think there's a couple of different ways, of course. Like the kind of most obvious is probably grants, like being able to just access funds at various stages of the business development, whether you've got and I think this is where governments have a really important role to play in underrepresented founders and making sure that people who don't have as easy access to capital, for example, are still being given opportunities through that would otherwise be available if, for example, they were based in the city and they were able to engage often with the VCs that are based in the CBD. Like if you're in a regional area, it's so much harder, obviously, to build those networks and make those relationships and connections. So there is a government role there, for example, to help underrepresented founders start. One of the things that came up this year in particular was the MVP grant, which is one of Australia's most popular startup grants. And it started in New South Wales as this pretty generous pot of money. You could get up to $200,000 last year to, like, obviously to help build your MVP. And that has been cut away to something like 25 to 50K. So that's like fundamentally changed what that grant is. It's not the same grant that it was before. And you go, okay, well, I'm not allowed to, like the grant stipulations say that I'm not allowed to use it on wages. So I'm like, okay, I'm starting up this really small business and I'm supposed to spend all this like tens of thousands of dollars on like capital and building something without having access to any money to have the people behind that. Like it just doesn't make sense as a grant anymore. So government, I think in developing this new grant has misunderstood what the landscape actually needs. And so a good governance role is to go in and say, well, what do startups actually need? Like they probably actually need people more than building like different products and acquiring capital that they may not need in the future, or like buying property that they almost certainly will grow out of or unfortunately not need in the future. Like it's things like that where government needs to be engaged with the industry. So that's kind of the grant side, which can go very right or can really miss the mark, and it'd be a waste of time for founders, which is terrible because they're applying for things that end up costing them more in the hours that they've spent applying for a grant than what they end up getting, or they're kind of led down the garden path and it's not going to be useful for what they're actually trying to build anyway. And then you've got more like regulatory type support. So you might be looking at tax incentive. Like obviously the R&D tax incentive was a pretty huge shift in the way that the Australian government thought about like how it could benefit businesses. So tax is a really useful lever to change priorities and incentives for businesses and startups. I think there's also stuff for me, like obviously I'm in a state government space, so that like broader tax conversation is kind of out of reach for my jurisdiction. But certainly in a state level, we have payroll tax. Like where can we have payroll tax exemptions for businesses that are startups? Like we, I believe, shouldn't really have payroll tax at all because I don't understand how it's useful to tax employing more people, which is good for everybody, because those people end up getting their income taxed anyway. But are there specific ways that we can change like a tax landscape? It could be something to do with land tax as well, where you reduce land tax for property owners who allow startups to exist and operate in their buildings, things like that. So it can go from that like really obvious, like here's the money, and that might be loans as well as grants, I should say. And then there's the kind of deeper incentive and disincentive world of like tax reform, for example.
One of the things we're finding interesting in some of the convos we're having too is people who don't maybe fit or maybe like knowledge or understanding of what pathways exist for people out there in startups. So like you mentioned, if someone is coming in very green, like for people who are starting startups within the startup ecosystem, I feel like they know what's out there or how they can sort of tackle it. But sort of like we've got a bunch of people that we come across even on the pod, they're running these amazing businesses and you say, oh, have you heard about these startups? They didn't even know what a startup is. It's like, oh, no, you're running one. You know what I mean?
But not it.
You're it. You're doing it. But for us, it's like the big gap, I think, at the moment, or just understanding how early it is in, I guess, the startup infrastructure in this country is like the funding element and the capital element of it. Like how do people who might not be building something that what traditional VCs here in Australia, they're looking for 100x, 1000x return for a unicorn sort of companies. What sort of other pathways exist out there for founders trying to make shit happen who they might not, like they're not targeting that super high crazy growth, but they're targeting solid, great businesses, they're going to employ people, they're going to change the world, they might be climate or impact focused, they're doing other good stuff, but their access, like you mentioned before, it's like whether it's not they're not represented or it's just the stuff that allows them to get to that place is either not there yet or they don't know where it is. Have you come across any of that in convos you're having?
I think it's a really interesting point, and because particularly like that is your wheelhouse, like you are building this incredible community that might otherwise have not existed. And part of that information and knowledge sharing is making sure that people feel connected to other people who are going through a similar thing or have gone through that thing before. And I mean, as I said to you when we met, like what you have been able to build through your passion and podcast and your social media outreach is quite remarkable. Like I think it's so amazing. I really pay tribute to you both because it's something that you've...
We're going
to
clip that.
Yeah, I mean, really, it's so important because a business environment doesn't exist in a silo, obviously. Like all businesses like need connections. You need customers, you need suppliers, you need expertise to build up. And so the more access that people have to ask questions and to draw on expertise, the better. Like in Sydney and also Western Sydney, we have the startup hubs. Like they have been places that people can go where you've got people like Fishburners, organizations like Fishburners, Stone and Chalk, those kind of groups which are trying to bring together founders and bring together experts who can feed into that environment and like share knowledge. And I would say, like, in New South Wales at the moment, there is a good core community, but I think there's always room to do more, always. Like, that core community will get older and get more experienced, and they'll probably be a little less close to being a startup founder than they used to be. And you need to have this constant like regeneration or building of the startup community. Like, that's the whole, for me, that's so much a part of the excitement of it, that there's so much to solve and to think about and to build, really. So yeah, I mean, we unfortunately had funding cut to the startup hub in Sydney. So that's a problem. Like, that's a place where people can go to find out information about specific grants that they might be eligible for, or a specific VC that's looking for, you know, like Regen, for example, is really focused on climate solutions. So if you've got a startup that's looking at climate solutions and you're Australian based, like, go to Regen, but you might not know that otherwise. Like, those spaces are really valuable. So yes, that's like, as I said, part of the real value of your work.
Regen Ventures is Dan Fitzgerald, isn't it?
Yes, yeah.
He's the king.
What a legend. Oh yeah. My gosh. Yeah, it's so awesome. And I think kind of like what's cool about his story, and probably the story of many founders, is the opportunities to be in big business and like big successful, like money spinning businesses, and then being able to take that knowledge and expertise and taking the risk to start something new. Like, there's at the moment, I'm sorry that this is a bit New South Wales centric, but there's a lot of talk about the Western Sydney Aerotropolis. It's supposed to be this new high-tech hub, obviously a new airport where we've got international connectivity, super excited. We've got major international tech companies coming in. But the stories recently, and really even over the last week, have been that these big tech companies are worried that there's not enough energy and there's not enough focus on getting this aerotropolis done. So they're starting to move away. And the reason that that's bad for startups and kind of innovation more broadly is that you lose the job opportunities that people had to go into those like global businesses and have that knowledge and then take that and start their own thing. Like, it's a whole ecosystem that's not just about like startups. It's also about how big business is able to contribute and provide knowledge and support as well, like even through their own kind of like VC offshoots. Like, obviously a lot of banks have that at the moment, which is cool.
That's a real good answer. Love that answer.
Love that. I think 100%. Hey, question we ask all our guests, Jackie, is a bit of a mental health one. What do you turn to when you look to get some energy back in your life?
I'm an extrovert, so I do like being around people a lot, and that gives me a lot of energy, and I'm grateful for that. But I do try to meditate, for example, like even if it's 10 minutes, but like try to do that as regularly as possible. I do like to get as close to 8 hours as I can, which is not always possible when you're in Parliament till like 2 a.m. sometimes, and then you have to be back in for the next day. But I do try to prioritize sleep as much as I possibly can. And I think, like, it is a profession where, I mean, it's a funny thing. Like, in a way, you can do as much or as little as you like. Like, I'm not, like, the reality is I don't get elected again for another 7 years. So it's really about making the most of the opportunity and making sure that I am in the best position to make the most of this opportunity. And so having good friends, and like this Christmas break was really nice because I saw lots of different groups of friends, and they very generously would organize things, and you see 20 people at one Christmas lunch, and then you go to the next one and there's 20 people you haven't seen. I'm like, oh my God, I haven't seen you all for like a year. I'm really sorry. Like, work has, like a startup founder, work is everything. Like, you just got to pump it out. So being able to see friends when I can, sleeping well, meditating, Maintaining, I don't know. I love my job and I'm really grateful for everything that I have in my life. And I think having gratitude as a kind of fundamental basis of my life has been really helpful as well. Like, things can go up and down and all that sort of thing, but like, I'm grateful to be here, so got to make the most of it.
I think when life gets crazy too, I feel the guilt as well, like friends and fam. It's like when work is so demanding and it's like, I've got to be present, I've got to be on. It's hard. It's like a hard transition when you're saying no to these things, when you're like, I really value our connection and our friendship, but I've got to make this stuff happen. And it's like the comms and all that sort of stuff is like really important because you don't want to burn people in your life, but you also want to do good stuff with your work.
Well, opportunities don't always come around.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like sometimes opportunities, as quick as they're there, they can be gone. And I feel like, especially in what you're doing, it's like, love to hear the fact that it's a cool thing that you're in there for a long enough period of time where you can make some meaningful change. But I'm sure that if you didn't take that mindset, then you probably wouldn't be able to.
Yeah, I guess so. I think, you know, the true friends in your life and will understand. Family is possibly a bit harder because, you know, they might be relying on you in a different way. And I don't have kids yet. So that does weigh on my mind a little bit. Like, how do I, if I'm lucky enough to have children, like, how do I be a good mother? And that, I think, like, your values are represented in the way you live. Like, that's, it's kind of like undeniable. I can say that I care about all of these different things, but my values are very clearly represented in how I spend my time every day. And being reflective about that, I guess, is an opportunity to say, well, even if I can't spend a lot of time with my family right now, am I still looking after them in fundamental ways? As you said, am I still communicating with them? And do they understand why I'm doing what I'm doing? Do they understand, like, why this is important to me, or, you know, why I think this is valuable to them as well? Like, if I have a child, for example, that child knowing that I'm doing my job because I think it's for, you know, a bigger purpose in some way, and that hopefully makes their life better, and it allows them to see that they've got opportunities in their life as well. And I think that that's probably the same in business. Like, you want to be successful, you want to be able to provide for your family, you want to make sure that you're giving something back. Like, the best businesses or business people, I think, are really motivated by this idea that they're giving something to society. Like, that's what great business does. And it could be anything from, I don't know, being lean to a climate tech startup. Like, those things are giving something valuable to us all. So yeah, it's about making those dreams real, I guess.
I like that. Yes. Well, thank you so much for spending some time with us in early 2024. Excited to see what comes up in your world this year. And again, thank you so much.
Yeah, pumped.
Really appreciate it. Thank you so much for everything you're doing. It's been so good to get to know you and can't wait for the year ahead.
Jay Munro, I've got to say, she'd be straight in the top friends, I reckon, if MySpace was still around. I know I've used that joke a little bit, but she's cool.
I thought in 2024 you might bring out a new joke. I thought you were definitely going to leave with Jackie.
You wanted to do that? Because I wanted to hear you sing.
Every time I ask you to sing on the pod, you never do it.
Yeah, because you put me on the spot. You just can't do that to...
Sing now.
No, you just can't do that with professionals. You just got to let them just have some time off and chill.
Let the moment be the moment.
Yeah. Well, for me to sing, I need to get some honey out, I need to gargle it, I need to just get in the zone. You know, I can't just belt it out like you.
Brush your teeth, have a shower.
Yeah, a little bit. We actually had an 8 a.m. meeting this morning and I didn't shower and the teeth got brushed. I know. I'd love to say they didn't, but they did. They got furry pretty quickly.
I could smell you. I could smell you when you got in the car. I thought, fuck, is he... He's on the nose a little bit. Hey, well, if you're new to Funny Business or if you like this chat, please get involved with the Dream Big Social Club. Plenty of stuff happening this year for an ecosystem for startup operators, founders and investors doing big things. And literally we've got the newsletter coming out, probably first one of the year, probably either coming out next week, I think.
Haven't spoken about it, but you just put it out there.
I just put it out there. I'm just thinking out loud.
We don't know. Startups, let's be real. We don't actually know.
We think on our feet. But seriously, some of the latest interviews, we've got some exclusive content. So if you like the Funny Business content, think of the Dream Big Social Club as written, but more.
Hey, funny business listeners, Caleb from SquareX here. I just wanted to jump on and let you guys know at the end of this ep, SquareX is currently open for investment. So if you're interested in learning more about what we do at SquareX and want to get involved in the digital future of the agricultural supply chains, you can reach out to me directly on LinkedIn or to the Dream Big Social Club team to learn more.